my wife, she basically said, you have 6 months of playing with this thing. If you don't find money, you go and get a job. So that was the first step. Basically, you had concrete thing you have to accomplish, right? You have a very clear. The second thing is I didn't have the courage to do it alone. So there was a guy that I worked with a few times in the past. His name is Ariel Milstein, and we founded the company together. So I convinced him to join, and we founded the company together.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Benny Buller is founder of Velo 3D. Velo 3D is a metal 3D printing technology company that recently went public. The company unlocks true design freedom and enables customers in areas such as space exploration, aviation power generation, and energy to innovate the future in their respective industries. It's really cool the things they are involved with. Using Velo 3D, these customers can now build mission-critical metal parts that were previously impossible to manufacture. Benny has a super interesting story. From his days at university studying physics and applied physics, his work in the military was an opportunity to apply his own knowledge on incredibly important tasks at a super young age. You can sense his passion for what he does and what he's built at Velo 3D in this interview. It's a fascinating new world in the 3D printing industry, and Benny is at the front of it. I began my conversation with him asking if growing up, he ever thought he'd be an entrepreneur and one day build a company like Velo 3D.
I grew up in Israel, and my dad actually had started his own company. And my dad is a physicist as well. And I probably got into physics somewhat inspired by him, kind of physics and math, someone through friends. So I actually had a very deep interest in theoretical physics when I was young, and always was sure that I will be working in theoretical physics all my life. And the person that is responsible for diverting me from this path is my wife. And she basically said, you'll have to make a choice between wife and life. So she basically kind of got me to thinking about more practical things. And while I was in undergraduate, I basically got into applied physics and optics and kind of got into it and never looked back. I really loved it.
Yeah. And then I know, you know, growing up in Israel and having to be in the army there, were you able to apply what you learned at university and then also most likely learn more in terms of physics while you were in the military?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll actually connect the two things together in with your first question about, you know, the entrepreneurship. So I went on a program that is called the Academic Reserve in Israel, where people, instead of going and serving in the army, they first go and study and then they go and they serve in the army. But they would serve in the army in their profession, not 3 years, but either typically 6 years, 5 or 6 years. So I went to the Academic Reserve studying physics and math. As I was studying in the university, I started to think about where am I going to go in the army? What am I going to do in the army? And I started to do a little bit of a research and inquiry about that. And I found that basically most of the jobs people do in the army in their profession are very tedious, right? They're not super exciting. There is one unit, though, that was doing a really, really exciting stuff, that the technology unit of the intelligence. And I started to see what these guys exactly do, which was very difficult because they were very secret. But I was able to connect bits and pieces, and I realized that they hire only one physicist every year. So draft only one physicist every year. And what they do is, with this physicist, they do something that has to do with optics and electro-optics and stuff like that, optoelectronics. So I figured I'm going to trick the system. And while I was in undergrad studying physics, I also did a graduate studies in applied master's in applied physics at the same time. And I was wise enough actually to complete both degrees at the same time. So when I went to the interview and I told them that I'm doing that, they said, okay, fine, you can come here. We definitely want you, but you'll have to sign extra year. And I said, why do I have to sign extra year? And they said, because you are studying master's and people that study master's sign another year. I said, but I am not asking you to prolong my studies. I'm doing that at the same time. Why do I have to sign an extra year? So, okay, you don't have to, just come and join us now. So, but I didn't finish my studies. So I said, okay, we'll just take you as is. No, no strings attached. And the thing that actually strikes me today, retrospectively, I have to say, I didn't think about this that much then. I was 19 years old when I cooked this, right? And so I had kind of the maturity to go figure out, make a plan, and then negotiate with the army. And it will work out perfectly. I also actually negotiated with my advisor because I basically had to finish my thesis in like about 4 months. And when I told him that I'm kind of going to finish in a few months, he's like, no, you're not. I need you to do all that. He was just starting in the university. And I said, look, the whole thing was just for me to get into the unit. Now that I get into the unit, I couldn't care less about my master's. So if you don't want, I'll just leave and go. So that was an exercise in Israeli diplomacy.
I love that. Exactly.
That worked. But really, the unit that I worked with was the entrepreneurial place that, you know, that you referred, place. So basically, it was a place that was run by kids. So I joined there when I was 22 years old. The average age there was like 24, 25. People left there when we were 26, 27 years old. The commander of the unit was maybe 35, 38 years old. It was a fantastic place with very talented people, the most talented group of people that you could meet. A lot of real geniuses going around, real experts in their fields. And we basically were assigned Mission Impossible projects that were super valuable for the kind of Israeli security doctrine. And we executed on those projects, delivered, the systems were installed. We got very often National Security Award from the President of Israel. I got one. And basically every year people left the army and then they thought, what did we learn in the army that we can apply in the civilian world? And they started companies that were based on things that they did in the army, but they figured how to apply that in the commercial world. And if you look at the Israeli startup and entrepreneurial environment in the 90s, this was the incubator. So there were two units, this my unit and the other intelligence unit. So my unit was responsible for the system that bring the intelligence to Israel. The other unit was responsible for crunching this intelligence and getting useful data from that. So those two units are basically the units that incubated the Israeli startup ecosystem and kind of a startup nation. And everyone in this unit knew that when they are done, they have to go and start the company. And if you didn't, it's like something was wrong about you. In my case, by the time I was done, I had two children. It's my wife again. Told me, no startup.
Another choice.
No startup for you. It's too risky. And then my startup, I started when the kids kind of started to get grown up and move away from the home.
Yeah, it reminds me, there's a guy I had on the show, Todd McKinnon, who started a big tech company called Okta. And he had this great job at Salesforce. And he had to put a PowerPoint presentation together for his wife to convince her to let him leave his job at Salesforce to go start this company, which is now on like the NASDAQ. And it's amazing.
I actually saw the presentation, I think. This is a very famous story. Yeah.
He has anyone out there who is trying to convince their wife at this point, they should pull that up. But for you and coming out of that environment, I can only imagine similar to MIT, let's say here in the US, or the intelligence, the people you were around. Was there anything that you took from those people, be it personality-wise, or was it that they were just so smart that it was hard to take something from them? But was there something you got that you felt you could go build a business?
Yeah, for sure. So there is I can say that, you know, I was molded in this unit together with all the other people that were in this unit. This unit really molded us. And there are a few things. So first, like the slogan of this company, the motto of this unit was translated freely to English: knowledge, will, and dedication will make the impossible possible. And we basically, every project that we started with, when you start on that, you look, that's impossible. There's no way to do that. But then when you start looking into this and you start thinking, and really smart people start brainstorming, it's like, oh, sure, you know, you can do that, and maybe you can do that, and you can reframe how you think about the problem. And you always learn, really, that there is always another way to think about problems and to reframe them, that they become solvable. So that was one big learning. The other thing is the place was extremely entrepreneurial and extremely initiative supportive. So you basically could just go and do anything and then ask forgiveness for that. So this was a really big thing about asking forgiveness, not asking permission. And it was a place where you were encouraged to go and ask a lot of questions and go kind of above and beyond. So I became a manager 1 year after I joined there, right? So at age 23, I became a manager. At 25, I became a pretty significant group manager. So you get an opportunity to lead. All of that is simply by initiative, right? They look at the people that take initiative, that look beyond what they are supposed to. We also, these projects were very sophisticated in terms of integration. So kind of learning how to think at things at the very high level has been very critical for us. So for example, I'll give you when I interview engineers, and I actually don't do this as much as I like to or used to in the past, but when I used to, I always like to ask engineers, tell me about what you did. That's how I do. So just tell me what you did. And we go into a conversation about what they did. And I ask them, so why did you do that? And why that was required? And a good engineer, you can basically start about what they do, and then you can go and ask 5-6 questions outside of their responsibility. And they know that. They know the system, they know the product, they know the environment enough that they can provide you enough depth, 5-7 questions out. On the other extreme, you have someone that will answer you within a question or two. Oh, that was outside of my scope. You know, I did that. That was outside of my scope. I don't know much about that. Or, you know, that was how it was decided. And there was nothing like that in this unit. So everyone was encouraged to do that. And the whole place relied, because we moved extremely fast, the whole place relied on those people that would be, if you want, the glue between the puzzle pieces that will make the whole puzzle work. This puzzle was made in a way that was not meant to fit to each other. There were just pieces, and it was relying on people that will go beyond, above and beyond their role, and will fill the gaps in between to make this whole thing work. So a lot of things that I learned, and a lot of things about culture and about inspiration and empowerment and about initiative. So definitely this is the place that formed me more than any other job that I did in my life. Everything else was continuation for that.
Are you still in touch? Have you kept in touch with a lot of those people that you went through this with?
Absolutely. We have a WhatsApp group that I get messages daily.
It's awesome. It's just incredible, just because of, you know, to think back what you were doing and what you were doing at such a young age and the importance of it, especially when you're dealing in terms of security. And it must make it seem like going and building big public companies now is nothing. I hate to say that in comparison, but tell me, how did you discover, or how did you really start to focus and build your business on 3D printing? How did that come about?
Yeah, so I basically, when I came to the United States, I worked in large companies, and first in semiconductor, then in solar. And then when I finished my work in First Solar, I decided I want to start a company, and I didn't know in what, but I was at the age, and my kids were at the age, and I was in the financial state that I could say, okay, I can take a risk. I can take a risk. My family is there with me now, and my wife was with me, importantly. And I started to think about where exactly am I going. And it so happened that I actually got approached by Kosla Ventures, and Kosla Ventures kind of proposed to me to go and work with them. And I wanted to be an EIR, an entrepreneur in residence. And they said, well, Vinod actually said, Vinod Kosla, why don't you just join us for a few years, be an investor, see how it is. Maybe you'll want to stay, maybe you'll want to start a company. I kind of suspected that I would want to start a company, but I said, okay, let's go and see how it works. And that was a great school for me, because until that, I spent a lot of time in engineering and product development. I spent a lot around manufacturing, not in manufacturing, but around manufacturing and around operations. But I really didn't know much about any other part of the business, right? About finance, about business, about business strategy, about fundraising, about sales, marketing, right? And I said, okay, that's great. And I got into that. And I basically spent 2 years mostly working with a lot of portfolio companies, but also looking at a lot of companies that we looked into investing, also made some investments myself as an investor. And that was the best school you could have for entrepreneurs. So the 20 years or so of product development plus 2 years of being an investor were a fantastic school. And Kosla Ventures is an amazing school for that, because Vinod is so visionary. And he's surrounded by such a great people that this was really great. And he is also not only visionary, but he is also very clear, if you want, guidelines about how to think about investment and how to think about entrepreneurs. And he filters very quickly. So I learned a lot in this period. And I learned a lot about startups and about business and about mistakes that you don't want to make. And one of the things that I learned, and I made a vow on this, is that I will never invest in a 3D printing company. And I actually decided never to invest in a 3D printing company, because the information that I received from all the startups that came asking for money or pitching was, this is a great industry. This is a great technology. You can do that whatever you want. The only problem is cost. You need to drive the cost down. And here is a play to drive cost down by such and such factor. And you know, and sometimes it was by 30%, and sometimes it was by 10 times, mm-hmm. and sometimes it was by 70%. But there was all this split. And one of the things you see is that the industry is very fragmented. There's a lot kind of technology. Each is doing something slightly different. And then there are tens of plays to reduce cost. And I already was an investor in cleantech by that time, and I spent a lot of time in solar. And I could see that in an industry where there are tons of startups that everyone is working to reduce cost, is an industry where no one is going to make money in, because everyone is like falling on each other and everyone is disrupting each other. And no one will actually, it's very difficult to get to scale where you can actually get the cost benefit, because in the beginning, everything is more expensive, right? Only when you get to scale, things become cheaper. So I kind of look at that and I said, I don't know. It doesn't sound like the right industry. And then we invested in a company that has been building rockets. And they have been designing and building their rocket engines using 3D printing. And it turned out that the parts that they wanted to design were non-manufacturable. So all the parts that they were making, they were very small parts at the beginning, took them a few months to make, even though they were, you could hold them in the palm of your hand. And I said, wait a second. I saw the whole thing about 3D printing. You can print parts overnight. You make the part, you go home, and in the morning you have the part. That wasn't at all how this thing was. The people wanted to make parts, but the parts were non-manufacturable. They had to basically go and redesign the parts, tweak them, compromise the designs until they got something that they needed. And I said, okay, wait a second. I want to see if this is a problem with this company or if this is a problem with the industry. And I started to talk with other users that have been using the technology. And to me, the most kind of the point where everything is sank and basically I said, yeah, I'm doing this, was I had a meeting with SpaceX and I had 8 engineers around the table. We talked about this topic and we talked about how they are doing and what they're using it for and everything. And then at the end, I was like, okay, I want to understand, you know, the bottom line. You're doing these designs, you're making 3D printing, you're making parts, you're making engines with 3D printing. How limiting are the existing capabilities of the manufacturing technology to you? You know, we talked about these limitations, how big of a deal it is. And they said like this, they said 70% of our parts, we print first shot, no problem. Easy. About 20-25% of our parts take us 2-3 iterations. We figure out how to make tweaks on them so that we can print them and make them a little challenge. And then about maybe 5% of our parts, we spend up to a quarter, 3 months. We play, we try, we change. And after 3 months, we give up on them and we move on to something else. So I said, okay. So for this customer, I wrote in my notebook in Hebrew, for this customer, the solution of the limitation of the manufacturing technology is a very limited marginal value. As I was writing that, one of the engineers in the other side of the room kind of says, you know, you have to understand something. that we have been 3D printing rocket engines for more than 5 years now. You will wake up any one of us in the middle of the night and you'll show them a part. They can tell you without putting glasses on if this part will print or not successfully. So the reason why we have this distribution is because we know what will not print successfully and we avoid those designs. He said, had we had the capability to make this 5% of the parts, 100% of the parts would be like that. We don't do that because there's no capability to do that, but it's not, there is no need. So I was like, okay, I got it. That's what I'm going to do. I didn't know how am I going to do it, but I knew that that's what we were going to do because there was a clear market problem here. And not only that, it was a market problem that everyone was missing. Because when you talked with everyone, no one told you that that's the problem. When you ask them, so is it really a problem? People are like, yeah, it is a problem, but there's nothing you can do about this. It's kind of like when you ask people that are overweight, no one tells you gravity is too high, you know, G is too high. It's like, that's not, it's like gravity is gravity. It is what it is.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors. Are you constantly finding yourself with 50 tabs open a day, hopping between tools just to do your job? Notion is the most customizable tool that helps teams organize information, manage projects, and get more work done together, all in one place. More than 70% of teams that use Notion stop using two or more tools because they didn't need them anymore. With powerful integrations, an API, and seamless navigation, you'll have everything you need in one spot so you can make speed your advantage without the silos and context switching that slow companies down. Plus, Notion has a worldwide network of millions of users, creating templates, tutorials, and new inspiration. The product is getting better all the time, and you'll always have the support you need. Learn more and get started for free at notion.com/howsuccesshappens. That's notion.com/howsuccesshappens to help you take the first step toward an organized, happier team today.
And our next sponsor.
Are you a small business owner? Did you know that Visa's online small business hub has tools, discounts, and resources to help you run your business? So whether you're a business beginner or an entrepreneurial expert, find the solutions, tools, and tips you need to help take your business to the next level. Plus, if you have a Visa business credit or debit card, you can get access to cardholder benefits like Visa Savings Edge, a savings program which can help you save on everyday business expenses like office essentials, travel, and more. When you enroll your Visa business card in Visa Savings Edge, you'll have access to valuable offers which can help turn qualifying business purchases made with your enrolled Visa business card into savings for your business. Learn more at visa.com/small business hub. Once again, that's visa.com/small business hub. Visa, a network working for everyone. And we're back. You found the opportunity. You had that light bulb moment. How do you then go from that point right there and say, even after you'd been extremely successful in your career, how did you go from that point and say, I am going to start this business? And was it challenging just to get it going and get it off the ground?
So my wife, again, she's a
I have the same problem, by the way.
it's not a problem. It's absolutely not a problem. But my wife, she basically said, you have 6 months of playing with this thing. If you don't find money, you go and get a job. So that was the first step. You know, basically you had concrete thing you have to accomplish, right? You have a very clear. The second thing is I didn't have the courage to do it alone. So there was a guy that I worked with a few times in the past. His name is Ariel Milstein, and we founded the company together. So I convinced him to join. And we founded the company together. And he's a very brilliant physicist, and very brilliant technical person and system engineer. And we invented it together. When we started, we didn't know exactly how we were going to do it. We wrote some bullshit PowerPoints about, you know, what we're going to do. This is a classical example of how you don't know what you're going to face.
That's true.
Completely. And we raised money. And the truth is we raised money from a lot of people that knew me and that trusted me and trusted my reputation. So we basically got seed money and we started going. And the first, and we had seed money. And the first few months were grueling. So first, this whole stage that we were in since. So first, we were completely wrong about what we thought the technical problem is that we need to solve and how to go about that. It took us about 2 months to figure that we were wrong. So we learned that we were wrong. We didn't know what we were talking about. But in 3 months, we already quite knew quite a lot about what we were talking about. But we still knew. Now we knew what the problem is, but we had no idea what the solution is. The second thing is we had money for about 12 months, maybe 15 months. And every week, I felt exactly the same way. Every week on Monday, I looked at what we have to do, and I got into a depression. It looked like there's so much to do. There's so little time to do. I don't really know what's the problems. In many cases, I hardly know what the problem, but I definitely don't know what the solution is. And then by Friday, we solved the problem. We solved something. And you go home with a euphoria. It's like, yeah, nothing can stop us. And that was like every week. Every Monday, you go into a depression. And every Saturday, you go accelerated with a sense of euphoria. So the first few years were very, very hard because we were basically on the edge of extinction. And it was extremely, extremely, extremely challenging.
I love that because for every entrepreneur who's out there and knows that feeling, no matter the business, and talking to major businesses like your own and across the board, that feeling of the roller coaster of we're done, this is finished, to you're on top of the world and then right back down. And it's such an incredible thing to note. Most people see you or they see successful entrepreneurs, they think it's, you know, it's a rocket ship. And there's so many challenges. It's always great to hear. What do you think it was? It's hard waking up. I've been there as an entrepreneur every Monday, knowing you're facing it again. And you know, hopefully you'll get to that Friday. What do you think it was internally? Was it something internally in you, your partner, that was able to get you off the mat and just keep moving forward?
It's actually a really good question. And I think that different entrepreneurs are different about in terms of what is their driver, right? What is their source of energy? I definitely never did that for money. And I definitely never did that for power or control. I kind of think of myself almost as an artist. I'm really poor anything artistic, right? I cannot rhyme. I cannot, you know, sing. I cannot do music. I cannot paint. But I kind of thought that problem solving is my expression, is how I find happiness in doing something for myself out. And for me, you get into these problems and you're sucked into these problems and you basically forget about the context. It's like, okay, what will happen if this is not going to work? Okay, let's just work on that. So if you can disconnect from what will happen if this is not going to work and just focusing on let's make it work, it's a very, very relaxing, very calming state. You almost get into a meditative state. So for me, it always was like, okay, yeah, I got it. We have all these problems. Let's not think about this. Let's just think about how we solve them instead of what will happen if we don't solve them.
Yeah, I love that because it's so important. I've learned this over the years, just even recently, of staying in the process in the moment and not catastrophizing and thinking 6 months down the road, you lose money, you're going to lose all your money and you're going to be done. And if you're able to do that and you're able to pick yourself up every Monday and go through it through Friday, things will happen like they did for you. And was there a moment? Has there even been a moment, even though you guys have grown tremendously and gone public? Was there a moment when you were like, you know what? We've created a really good business here. And I actually feel comfortable that this is going to be hugely successful. We're successful.
I can tell you if such a moment exists, it's still in the future.
I love that. I love that because every entrepreneur I talk to, and even if they've like, you know, it's like, I guess it's just not part of the entrepreneurial mindset. You know, that, hey, you know what? Ooh, we're a success and I'm going to go, you know, on the beach and, you know, this will all work out. And
I can tell you that we were twice almost bankrupt, right? So twice I had money for between one and two paychecks. In one case, it was for one more paycheck. In another case, it was for two more paychecks, right? I had VCs that were quarreling. I had debt to banks and debt to suppliers. And I had a VC that told me, no, don't worry about this. We'll support you. And the only question is, what are the terms? So there were quite a few times that it looked really, really dark. It looked like this is the end. So if you ask me, where are there times that it looked very close to be the end? The answer is much more obvious than where are there times that it looked like you made it. What we are trying to do is so hard, is still hard into the future, that I don't feel at all like we cleared all the debris and the road is paved and you can just put 90 miles an hour and just drive. It's like, this is not how it is. There is still a lot of problems. There is still a lot of existential problems. There's still a lot of business and technical and operational problems that we have to solve. So I definitely don't feel like we've done that. It's like, yeah, every step that we have accomplished is like, okay, now we can have the resources to go and to get closer to our vision.
And in terms of even the entire industry and 3D printing, has that been something for people who are not on the inside and even just when you're approaching new clients, is that something you're still having to educate people on? Is that part of what the job is now?
So a big part of our job is to educate customers, but it's actually to uneducate customers. So what it means is that for a very long time, people knew the limitations of 3D printing and they made decisions based on the knowledge of those limitations. And now we basically said, well, there is much less limitations than you actually thought. You can do much more than you thought. And that opens the space to do things that you couldn't do before. So in a very important way, we are trying to focus on business opportunities where no one else can address well. So if other people think they can do that, we tell them, okay, just go and do that. We prefer not to participate in competitive war opportunities where other people can do that. We prefer to really help in a profound, impactful way to customers. So when we go and we do this, we try to find how we can help. And very often we need to educate customers about what is possible and why what people told them in the past was true, but the world has changed. And that's a very important learning for me, because as an engineer, 4 years ago, I could prove in math why this company will never need marketing. And today I understand, and I had a good friend that tried to explain that to me 4 years ago, that marketing is just education. You just educate people. You're not trying to sell them anything. You just educate people. You teach them about things that would be valuable for them, that you can do for them. And this is really what marketing is about. Now I understand that. And spending time with people, both in a way that is focused as well as in a way that is broader, is very critical for people to understand that there's more out there.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com. Or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.